Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
Do you hear this? Birds singing. Winter is almost over. Spring is near. There's trace evidence of love in the air. And that got us in the mood to make a match. I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
I just want to go over the results of your recent hand x-ray.
My job is to care about everything.
The technical term for this is imagery, auditory imagery.
Telling yourself, like, it's going to get better. Like, next year will be better.
I like to think that we're all bones from Star Trek.
Yep, that's pain. Yep, it's bad.
Now people say, my God, that could be my child.
They never go away. They outlast every other piece of knowledge I've managed to acquire in my life.
They consume all the oxygen in the water.
There
are separate sensors for all of these things.
Today's show is about making matches, in a health and science kind of way, of course. We'll hear about young physicians being matched with their first jobs. We'll match opinions on healthcare with presidential candidates. We'll match surgery with the perfect date and a person with a much-needed organ. But first up, this is usually the time of year when we get the first warnings about swimsuit season, as if swimsuit season were some terrible national crisis that we all need to prepare for. Alas, if you're hitting the gym to stay in shape and perhaps shed some extra pounds that you've put on during the cold, dark months, chances are you're listening to something like this. Good tune, but you could optimize your playlist to get more out of your workout. How? Let's head to the gym with reporter Shai Benyakov.
Hi, good morning. Okay, so it's 5:30 in the morning, and about a dozen people here, most of them have headphones on. People on the treadmills, people on the elliptical machines. So I asked them why.
Gets you going, man. Get some of the EDM, a lot of the new club stuff. Keeps you up.
If I'm listening to music, it just makes it easier.
Gets me going.
It's the age of the super athlete. Faster, better, stronger. And even those of us like me with zero Olympic aspirations want to get the most out of our workouts. More and more research is looking into how music can optimize physical performance. And no one knows more about that than this man.
My name is Dr. Kostas Karageorgis. I'm a reader in sports psychology at Brunel University, London, in the UK.
Dr. Karageorgis is one of the world's leading experts on the effect music has on our bodies. His passion for this field of research goes back to his childhood in South London, where he lived above a record store.
So every morning, rather than being awoken by the sweet sound of birdsong or the sun breaking gently through the net curtains, there would be this thundering bass coming up through the floorboard. And I recall as I used to get up and wipe my sleepy eyes and look out of the window, I would notice that as people came within earshot of the music, their facial expressions would change, they would brighten up, their gait would change, they would be alert in it, and the music seemed to provide an auditory backdrop for everything that happened in the locale.
Observing the visible effects of music on people walking by led to a lifelong passion of understanding how music helps us perform. Scientific study into the field can be traced back to the early 20th century.
There was a cycle race at Madison Square Gardens in New York, and a chap did a study wherein he was interested in how the cyclists performed when the band was playing and when the band was not playing, and he noted that there was an ergogenic or a work-enhancing effect when the cyclists were engaged in the activity with the musical accompaniment.
What kind of music would that have been that the cyclists were listening to at the kind of around at the turn of the 20th century?
As I recall, it was just a brass band that was playing, and probably more to entertain the crowds than the cyclists.
Okay, so here I go. I'm getting on the treadmill. So, how can music make me run faster, work out harder? Well, Dr. Kara Georgia says there are a few things going on here. For one thing, music is a distraction. It takes our mind off the stress we're putting on our bodies.
Music captures or it blocks some of the messages that go from the working muscles and the organs to the brain. So it can reduce perceived exertion and make us feel as though we're working less hard.
Right. Well, I'm not listening to music right now, but if I were, it would be taking my mind off the pain in my knees and hips that's starting to get worse as I run more. But there's another more physical phenomenon. It's called entrainment.
And this is where we consciously try to link our movement patterns to the rhythmical qualities of the music.
So, for example, doing anything rhythmic, like running, has its own intrinsic beat. The problem is, our bodies have to maintain that beat. The right music essentially takes part of that effort off of our bodies. And Dr. Kara George's research shows it has a real effect.
The synchronization of bodily movements to a musical beat can result in about a 7% reduction in oxygen uptake. That is the amount of oxygen that we utilize in a minute.
Oh, good. Here comes the cool down. That's right. When we work out to music, we use less oxygen. Why?
If you imagine that you were driving a car from the outskirts of a city to the center, and every time you got to a junction, you encountered a green light rather than a red light where you had to stop, the amount of fuel that you would need to make that journey would be reduced. And similarly, there are fits and starts and inconsistencies in human movement. And what the music does is it has a metronomic type effect that makes our movements more regular, and thus there is an efficiency gain.
Okay, moving on to the dumbbells here. So the principle of entrainment can be used not just to synchronize heartbeat, but to fool the body into working harder. When Dr. Kara Georgis works with athletes, he assigns them workout music.
I would typically use a music tempo that is one or two beats per minute higher than an athlete's desired strides per minute. This will give the athlete a little push. It will make them run slightly faster, but the increase in effort will be imperceptible. If you try and bump it up by 5 or 6 or 7%, it's immediately perceptible, and it will make the athlete feel uncomfortable and will not have the desired effect.
Of course, not everyone has a sports scientist tracking their every workout. That's where this man comes in.
It's Shahriyar Nirjan. I was born and brought up in Bangladesh. I came to United States for my grad studies in 2008 fall.
It was during graduate school in computer science that Nirjan came up with the idea of an app that could get more information about the user's heart rate.
And our original idea was to use earphone, add some more sensors to earphones so that we can use them for medical applications.
But he thought that technology could be used for exercise as well. So he created Musical Heart. It's an app that, paired with a heart rate monitor, selects music that moves the user's heart rate closer to a target, say 130 beats per minute. And the more it's used, the more it learns what works for that individual.
You can say, like, after listening to 100 songs, that model will be more personalized than it was doing initially.
Okay, time for some sit-ups. There's a third way that music affects our bodies, something Dr. Kara Georgis calls extra musical association. That's where a piece of music is associated with a movie or a TV show, something lots of people are exposed to. Think, for example, of the iconic music from Chariots of Fire, which doesn't seem to fit any of the criteria of good workout music.
This is a relatively slow tempo. It's around resting heart rate. But because of the associations of those athletes striving for Olympic glory, it brings out the hero in us, and it makes us want to strive to be the very best that we can be.
Now, of course, I'm from Philadelphia, so you know what I have on my workout mix. For the Pulse,
I'm Shai Ben-Yaakov. Okay, three more.
Shai Ben-Yaakov is currently working on a new podcast called The Playground, about how physical activity plays a role in our lives. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Maiken Scott. For thousands of newly minted doctors around the country, this week marked a big moment in their career, Match Day. It's when young physicians find out where they will be for the next few years to complete their residency.
Nothing matters as much as where you did your residency. You know, it's that last sight of training that really determines the course of your career.
This is Maurice Hinson. We met him last year on the show, shortly before he was going to find out where fate and all of his hard work would send him next. Maurice grew up in Philly. He was raised by a single dad, Larry.
He's a blessed kid. I like to use the word blessed because I'm a godly person. I just feel that God has something for this boy to do.
So, a lot of pressure on Maurice there. His top choice for residency was Cornell. We also met Kelsey Persaud. She wanted to get into family medicine, but her situation was complicated by the fact that she had recently gotten engaged to her boyfriend, Evan. He was already in residency at a hospital in the South, so she was wondering, should she try to get to his hospital or pick her own path?
Do I want to just put this relationship on hold again? I got to start making decisions, you know, on a we basis and not so much on an I basis anymore.
The reporter who brought us this very compelling story about these two Drexel University medical students is here now, Marielle Segarra. And Marielle, you went to the match day ceremony with Kelsey and Maurice.
Yes, it's very dramatic. The students all sit in a big room and they each get handed an envelope, which they can't open until noon. So noon comes and they all open their envelopes at the exact same time. So here's what happened. It's Eastern Virginia Medical School, Evans Hospital, and now Kelsey's. They hug for the longest time. They're both crying. Maurice opens his envelope. A wave of screams erupt around him, but he stays quiet. It's Cornell.
That's right. Cornell.
Maurice ducks outside to call his dad, Larry.
Yo, Dad. Good. I just got my match results. I'll be in New York.
Marielle, you checked in with both of them. It's now exactly a year later. How are they doing?
They're doing well, all things considered. Residency can be a really hard time. Maurice was telling me, you know, he lost a little weight in the beginning. He wasn't taking care of himself. Now he's making an effort to do that, but he still has these really difficult moments in the ICU. And he told me that one of his hardest days as a resident was when a patient came in with an upper respiratory infection. She seemed to be doing well, and then she crashed.
We're doing CPR. Both of her sons were there. They were out in the hall crying. We did CPR for maybe like 20 minutes, and finally we called it. Then we went out and we talked to the family. You know, we were saying how sorry we were that everything happened. We tried to explain. We really had no explanation for why she died. And then in the midst of us talking to that family, the patient right next to hers started to crash.
Maurice said often there's not time to process what happened to one patient before he has to rush off to the next one. If he can, he tries to take a walk to clear his head, but usually it's not until the end of his 12 or 13-hour shift that he gets to go home and try to relax. And then he comes back in the next day and does it all over again. He said he still feels like an imposter, like he maybe doesn't belong there, but that's starting to change.
I think the first time I actually realized that I have actually learned something was when we had medical students. They were like asking me questions, like, what are you doing in this situation? And I had an answer for them.
You also checked in with Kelsey Persaud. How is she doing?
She's good. She's in Virginia at the same hospital as her fiancé, Evan. And she said, given all the challenges of residency, that is a good thing.
I am so happy that I ended up coming here because, you know, residency, especially first year, is really hard. And it's nice to have kind of someone to come home to and someone to kind of just, you know, share your space and then, you know, share your experiences with who gets it.
Kelsey is getting into family medicine. How is she enjoying that program?
She likes it. She said that as a family medicine doctor, it's really important to build trust with the patient and to form a relationship with them. And like Maurice, she's also had some challenges with patients and realizing that you can't always do right by them. She tells me a story about one time when she went in to see a patient who'd come in previously, and Kelsey, her typical chipper, bubbly personality, she's all excited to follow up with the patient, and she walks into the room, and this is what happens.
Went to say hi to the patient, and as soon as I said hi, and I was like, hey, do you remember me? I saw you in October, this, this, and this. As soon as I said that, her face like went from a smile to like kind of a frown, and then all of a sudden she started crying and getting really upset and not really yelled at me, but started kind of just venting at me. She was like, yeah, I remember you. I don't want you to be my doctor. You guys were the ones that, you know, missed this big issue that happened with her heart.
So what happened? What did Kelsey do?
She apologized to the patient profusely before she even knew actually what had happened. She took responsibility for what had happened to the patient. And then she went back and went over the patient's files for more than an hour, trying to figure out what they'd done wrong. She said ultimately that the doctors had followed procedure and that she doesn't think there's anything they could have done initially. But it was really important to her to rebuild that relationship with the patient. And even apologizing like that changed the patient's demeanor. The patient started to come around, and Kelsey said she was able to start to rebuild that trust.
Marielle, thank you so much for the update.
Thanks.
And you can hear Marielle's original stories on Maurice and Kelsey on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Our show today is about matchmaking in a health and science kind of way, of course. When you're sick, you're feeling lousy, you go to the doctor's office, you want to be matched with a diagnosis, right? Imagine you go to see a cardiologist, you tell them that you have serious chest pain, you can't breathe, perhaps your arm is feeling numb, and the doctor says, okay, that sounds like a heart attack, without ever listening to your heart or hooking you up to machines to check things out. That sounds crazy, right? But one could argue that this is how diagnostics work in mental health. The framework used here is the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is published by the American Psychiatric Association. Here's an example. In the latest edition, number 5, the symptoms for major depressive disorder include insomnia, loss of energy and appetite, feeling worthless or hopeless, not a word about brain science or the genetics of depression.
What we need conceptually to make progress here is to rethink these disorders as brain disorders.
This is Thomas Insull, the longtime head of the National Institute of Mental Health. The agency is the most powerful funder of research in this field in the world. Insull set in motion a dramatic shift in categorizing and diagnosing illnesses. In April of 2013, he declared in a blog post that the DSM had a lack of validity. A lot of people read it as if the Pope had denounced the Bible. And then in September of last year,
Dr. Thomas Insull is moving from the government to Silicon Valley after 13 years as the director of the National Institute for Mental Health. It's not a job you might expect for a respected...
Insull was scooped up by Google, leaving behind an agency in transition with a lot of loose ends to tie up. We asked reporter Audrey Quinn to look into some of the challenges facing the agency, and she's going to do that in a 3-part series over the next few weeks. In today's first part, she explores what might replace the Bible of psychiatry.
Possibly the only thing more scary than public speaking is getting called out while you're public speaking. In the early 90s, Judith Ford was a neuroscientist at Stanford. She'd made her name in studying the aging brain. but she just recently shifted to schizophrenia research. She was presenting at a conference, a room full of strangers.
It was actually probably the first talk I had ever given at a conference on schizophrenia. And someone in the audience raised his hand, I think even stood up, and said, "How can you study schizophrenia? Schizophrenia is just a composite of a huge number of different kinds of symptoms, everything from hallucinations to delusions to thought disorder. How can you say anything about schizophrenia?" And I really had no idea how to answer that.
Ford says it was really pretty traumatic, but she went back to her lab and thought about what he said. She hadn't really been getting anywhere with her schizophrenia research, and by questioning the label of schizophrenia, he'd given her permission to move away from the DSM framework.
I decided that he was right. Schizophrenia is a real wastebasket of symptoms, and I should focus on one. So I decided instead of studying schizophrenia, I would study auditory hallucinations.
So this guy who was totally trolling you actually ended up helping you out.
Yes, very much, and I appreciate that. If only I could thank him.
Auditory hallucinations are sounds made by a person's own mind that the person believes are coming from somewhere else. They're one of the most common symptoms associated with a schizophrenia diagnosis.
There are certain times when I can actually hear my mother saying things like, you know, if you just get your hair off your face, you'd be such a pretty girl, Judy. I can almost really hear her voice, but I do not believe that it is my mother speaking. I know that it's coming from inside my brain.
What is it about your brain, do you think, that when you hear that "keep your hair off your face, Judy," you know that it's not real?
I think that it's because I have a mechanism. It's a way of tagging the experience as coming from self.
Ford wants to figure out what that mechanism is, because it seems to be weaker in people who have auditory hallucinations. She now heads a lab at UC San Francisco, where she uses electroencephalogram testing, EEG. She puts a cap full of electrodes on a person's head that picks up activity across the different regions of their brain and transmits that to a computer. This is all while she's having them do talking experiments.
They sit here like this and they go, ah, 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 ah.
She looks at their brain response, and she's found that in people who have auditory hallucinations, it's as if their brains don't really distinguish between their voice on tape and their voice when they're talking.
Basically, people with schizophrenia don't tag these experiences as coming from self as readily as healthy, normal people do.
She says this extends even into the experience of touch. Other researchers have found that some people with schizophrenia actually can tickle themselves. They're not discounting their own touch the way other people do. For a long time, this kind of brain research focused on a particular symptom didn't really mesh with the way the National Institute of Mental Health was handing out research funding. Bruce Cuthbert first came to the NIMH in 1998. He'd been studying mood disorders. He says pretty much all the Institute's research back then was based around DSM-designated syndromes, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, depression, each categorized by a framework of symptoms.
And there were really very simple-minded notions of diagnoses and how we measured outcomes. In fact, I was so frustrated generally with what I thought was the poor quality of the science that after I'd been here 7 years, I left.
He started his own lab at the University of Minnesota, but the Institute asked him back in 2009. Director Tom Insel was looking to change the way they directed research. The Institute had started to fear that by dividing up research by DSM categories, they were putting false limits on what people could study. Insel wanted a more science-based system for addressing mental illness.
He invited me to return to the Institute to lead this new effort that became called the Research Domain Criteria Project.
The project's called RDoC for short.
It calls for studying human patients who may have DSM disorders, but we look at the disorders in the context of these basic functions and how they are disrupted.
It helps to think of RDoC as basically a giant grid. Listed down the side, you have all the different functions that can be disrupted by mental illness, like memory, wakefulness, fear responses. And then along the top of the grid, you have all the different factors that could impact those functions. Genes, brain circuitry, behavior. The idea is to fill in the entire grid so we can have a research-based understanding of the different types of functions at every possible level. So when we talk about, say, anxiety, we know we're talking about something tied to a certain set of genes, a certain set of brain circuits and behaviors. Judith Ford, the auditory hallucination researcher, was at another conference just a few years ago when she ran into Bruce Cuthbert. He told her about the new RDoC system.
And we were standing out at one of those tall, now popular, like bar tables or something. And we were just standing there chatting, and he told me about this. And I said, oh, that's fantastic. I said, you know, this is how I think about it myself. And he said, I know, you know, because he knew what I was doing. And I said, yeah, this is great news.
She says it gave her a grid to plug in what she was already doing to a structure that had already been vetted by the NIMH. Not everyone's as enthusiastic. I talked to about half a dozen different psychiatry researchers. Most didn't want to go on record with their concerns about RDoC. But the phrase that kept coming up was, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Sure, they said, there's some flaws with the DSM system, but it gives us a common way to describe all the varieties of mental illnesses. But Cuthbert says that fear is mistaken. He's now the acting director of the NIMH, and he says they're not doing away with the DSM labels. They're even still funding research that follows the psychiatry Bible.
But that wide misunderstanding, I think, you know, caused a lot of consternation in the field, and we've been trying to clear up the messaging since then.
Yes, he says, the National Institute of Mental Health is saying that the RDoC system has better science than the DSM. But the RDoC system's not fully fleshed out yet. The grid it sets up still has a lot of holes in it. Figuring out how to more fully make that bridge from a system that's well-established, the DSM, to a system that's scientifically valid, the RDoC, that will be the job of the new director. For The Pulse, I'm Audrey Quinn.
Audrey Quinn is going to continue her series on the National Institute of Mental Health next week with a look at suicide prevention.
Listening to The Pulse, I'm Mike and Scott. We're making matches on today's show. And now onto an often difficult task, matching a surgeon's schedule with your own. Healthcare, of course, is one of those things that doesn't always work out when you want it to. Physicians typically squeeze you in around their schedules, not yours. But reporter Todd Bookman has the story of one procedure that the patient can schedule as he sees fit. And if he has any sense at all, he'll schedule it during March.
You're driving down the road, perhaps trying to drown out the kids in the back seat with a little sports radio, and this ad comes on.
Once again, the good docs over at Oregon Urology Institute have set aside extra time to perform vasectomies during the first days of the tournament.
For the past 9 years, the Oregon Urology Institute, just outside of Eugene, has promoted March Madness as the time of year for men considering a vasectomy. Since recovery from the 30-minute outpatient sterilization usually requires a couple days rest on the couch, the college basketball tournament, what with its Cinderellas, buzzer beaters, and 67 games packed over 3 weeks, is a natural fit.
You go in for a little snip-snip and come out with doctor's orders to sit back and watch nonstop basketball. What could be better?
What could be better? How about more commercial?
How about a bag of frozen peas to keep you comfy, plus some extra goodies we'll throw into the official Snip City recovery kit?
The immediate reaction was kind of both, I can't believe you're doing this, and that's hilarious.
Terry Fitzpatrick, who helps run the Institute, came up with the ad campaign. He says his colleagues in Oregon are proud that other urology clinics around the country have since jumped on the bandwagon, running similar promotions.
You know, it's more of a compliment that, gosh, we came up with something here in Eugene that everybody in the country wants to copy. We get a kick out of it all the time.
There's the pass to Leitner. Puts it up. Yeah!
Roughly 500,000 men join the V Club each year. The American Urological Association says it doesn't have any data to support a spike in March. But as we speak, there's at least one guy lying on the couch waiting for the games to start.
Yeah, I mean, they make it sound, pretty easy. A couple of days resting, nothing strenuous. So, you know, I mean, obviously I have my fingers crossed that that's true.
This is Chris, a 30-year-old Pennsylvania man who asked to not use his last name. He's got three little kids and a fiance who said enough is enough. We spoke earlier this week, just before he got snipped and the games tipped off.
Just a nice little reward for something that I'm not too excited about. You know, at least there's a little carrot on the end of the stick here.
Man, Vasectomy appointments are up this month by about 25% at the Philadelphia Center for Sexual Medicine, where Dr. Paul Gittins runs the show. He says tournament time is just another good reason for men to take charge of family planning.
When a woman undergoes a tubal ligation, that there's a little more risk involved. I think it takes a real man to step up and have the vasectomy done.
And if too long a line of real men means you can't get an appointment by the final four, Terry Fitzpatrick at the Oregon Urology Institute is ready with some other scheduling options.
In the last couple of years, we've also started doing one on Black Friday. Hey guys, you want to get out of shopping kind of deal.
It seems when you're talking vasectomy marketing, the well won't ever run dry. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
If you miss out on this, you'll end up recovering during a weekend marathon of Desperate Housewives. That's painful.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and our show today is about making matches. I was thinking about the elections yesterday, and I tried out one of those online matching tools that chooses a presidential candidate for who's most in line with your views and opinions. There were many questions, only one about healthcare. Should Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act stay or go? I figured, hold on, we have a much better resource for this kind of thing than a quick quiz. Julie Rovner. She's former longtime health policy correspondent for NPR, now senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News stationed in Washington, D.C. Julie, thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
What role is healthcare playing in this election cycle? It doesn't seem quite as big a topic as it was last time around.
No, nor is it going to be as big a topic as it was 2 times ago in 2008, when it really was one of the top issues. But healthcare is always going to be an issue in a presidential campaign as long as the economy is, because it's kind of a proxy for people's economic anxiety. If they think they're paying too much for healthcare, which most people think they are, that's one of the things that worries them about how things are going.
It has, of course, come up in most of the debates at one point or another. I want to hear some clips from our candidates. Let's start with the Democrats. Here are Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders.
I've been fighting for universal health care for many years, and we're now on the path to achieving it. I don't want us to start over again. I think that would be a great mistake to once again plunge our country into a contentious debate.
Every major country on earth, whether it's the UK, whether it's France, whether it's Canada, has managed to provide health care to all people as a right, and they are spending significantly less per capita on health care than we are. So I do.
Julie, both Clinton and Sanders want universal coverage, but what are the major differences in their approaches?
Well, I think it's really pragmatism versus idealism. Hillary Clinton is the pragmatist here. She tried very hard to get a very big health plan through when her husband was president in the 1990s, and that didn't happen. She stood on the sidelines a little bit when the Affordable Care Act was passed, but I think she was involved and saw what it took to actually get something through. Bernie Sanders, on the other hand, would like to sort of shoot for the moon and get a universal coverage plan similar to Medicare, which Democrats have been talking about, or at least some Democrats have been talking about for decades now. It seems unlikely that that would be possible in the current environment when the Republicans, as I'm sure we'll discuss, want to make even what's been accomplished go away.
Donald Trump, the Republican front runner, has said some perhaps conflicting things about health care. He has talked about wanting coverage for more people, but then he has also said that he wants to do away with Obamacare. Let's take a listen to something he's had to say on health care.
We are going to repeal Obamacare. We are going to repeal Obamacare. We are going to replace Obamacare with something so much better.
And there are so Julie, what is Donald Trump's plan for health care in this country and coverage?
Well, that's a really good question. He actually put out on his website a couple of talking points a few weeks ago. There have been some studies that suggest that it would take coverage away from about 20 million people and add coverage for about a little over a million people. He has said, as you pointed out, contradictory things about wanting to, continue coverage for people with pre-existing conditions, but he doesn't really say how. One of the proposals on his site actually just proposes what's already law about people with health savings accounts. So clearly health hasn't been a big priority for Donald Trump, and I don't think anybody has a really good idea of what he would actually want to do if he became president.
Ted Cruz has also said that he would repeal Obamacare. He's called socialized medicine a disaster. Here is something he has said in a debate about what he would do instead.
We will adopt common sense reforms. Number one, we'll allow people to purchase health insurance across state lines. That will drive down prices and expand the availability of low-cost catastrophic insurance. We'll expand health savings accounts, and we will de-link health insurance from employment so that you don't lose your health insurance when you lose your job. And that way, health insurance...
Julie, what do you make of that?
Well, of course, the first two proposals, expanding health savings accounts, which are accounts, tax-preferred accounts, where people basically use their own money to buy health care, making them more cost-conscious, allowing people to buy insurance from other states. Those have been sort of staples of Republican health plans for many years now. De-linking health insurance from employment is something that Republicans and some Democrats have talked about. They say that that having people get their health insurance through their workplace distorts the market because the employers are doing the choosing, and it would be better if people just, you know, bought their own coverage and it would be more portable. And that's, of course, in essence, some of what the Affordable Care Act does. What he doesn't say is how he would help people pay for that coverage if their employers aren't subsidizing it anymore.
John Kasich is still standing. He's still in the race. Many see him as the most moderate Republican candidate. Let's hear what he has to say about health insurance coverage and the prices attached to care.
I want complete transparency for our hospitals. You know, I want to know what's your quality, what's your price. And here's the thing. We know there's a midpoint between those that charge a lot and those that charge less. And there's often no connection on the quality side. So if you are a doctor and you are able to get me healthy at a cost below the midpoint, I'll give you a financial reward.
On his website, he does talk about things like having more patient-centered care and paying, having the system pay for value rather than volume. Interestingly, those are two things that the Affordable Care Act is already doing, is already trying to push the way the health care system is organized and the way care is delivered. So ironically, while he says he would repeal the Affordable Care Act, the things that he mentions doing are things that the Affordable Care Act is doing now.
Nobody knows who will be elected president, but let's say somebody gets into office who wants to repeal Obamacare. How quickly could that happen?
Well, it would be complicated if, you know, one of the Republicans gets into office and says they want to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Obviously, they can't do that by themselves. They would need Congress to do that. They could take away significant parts of it, and the president could do significant things just by directing the Department of Health and Human Services to enforce or not enforce things. So there certainly a president could throw a lot of sand in the wheels and make some significant changes. How fast that president might want to, given the dislocation that it might cause, is yet another question.
Julie, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Julie Ravner covered health policy for NPR for many years, and now she is senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. Right now, 15,000 people in the U.S. are hoping to make a very specific match. This is a matter of life and death. They need a new liver and are waiting for a transplant organ. For livers, average wait time varies from state to state. To get a transplant, people have to be sicker in some states, like Massachusetts or California, than others, like Indiana or Georgia. Some patients, desperate to save their lives, relocate, hoping for better chances. Reporter Karen Shakurji followed one young man as he left Boston in search of a new liver.
When I first met Seth Doraswamy last summer, he was holed up in his parents' house in Belmont, a suburb just outside of Boston. He had puffy cheeks, wide eyes, and shuffled around slowly in a big gray hoodie. We walked toward the dining room past framed photographs of Seth, his siblings, and their kids. White lacy curtains covered the windows and two fluffy dogs bounced around. We sat down and he told me about his life in Italy.
Before all of this happened, I was considered a builder and a stonemason.
He had been living in Genoa for the past 5 years, close to his wife's family, building homes.
Then this is one of the projects we're working on before I left. Lots of stone walls and cement mixers.
But while he showed me these photos of his physically demanding job, he struggled just to sit up straight.
Bricks in between each one of them.
Seth was born with a liver disease called biliary atresia. It basically means the liver is not filtering bile the way it's supposed to. At 11 weeks old, he had a risky procedure done that saved his life. For years, he took antibiotic after antibiotic to prevent infections. But in December of 2014, at 32 years old, the disease caught up with him again.
We were working on a big house. I was working with a lot of guys. One of them one day just said, "You know, your eyes are really yellow."
He was hospitalized for a couple weeks, and in January of 2015, he came back to Boston to be near his longtime doctor at Mass General Hospital. But Massachusetts, it turns out, is not the best place to be if you need a new liver.
When my doctor said, "We may think about sending you out to Indiana," I was kind of shocked.
Getting on a list in another state is not so simple. Entering the world of medical tourism meant leaving his doctor at Mass General Hospital, meeting a whole new team, going through extensive tests, and all the while dealing with an obscene amount of paperwork. He did go out to Indiana for 2 weeks in June, but it didn't work out, and he returned to Boston still needing a liver. I asked him to keep an audio diary if he traveled elsewhere, and he said sure. He thought Wisconsin might be next. But on August 17th, I got an update.
I had to postpone my appointment in Wisconsin, cancel my reservations for the flights. Then all of a sudden, I found myself booking flights for Florida, finding a place to stay in Jacksonville.
An appointment opened up at the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, and he bought a one-way ticket.
How are you?
Good, how are you?
Good.
I have an appointment with Adam.
If you're wondering what's in Florida that's not in Massachusetts, the answer is it's complicated. Since doctors started transplanting organs successfully back in the 50s, geography has played a key role. Organs are time sensitive. The average liver lasts about 6 hours after being procured from a donor. The closer the match, the better. In the 80s, the National Transplant Organization, called UNOS, divided the country into 11 regions. Then, in 2002, they implemented something called a MELD score, just for livers. It rates how sick a patient is. Today, a combination of your MELD score and location determines your place in line. The idea is to get the sickest patients transplanted first, but because some regions average transplants at lower scores, meaning you don't have to be as sick, people who can leave home to get on lists elsewhere.
And it's really tragic because the organs should be able to go to the patients wherever they live and not make the patients relocate.
David Mulligan is the chief of transplantation and immunology at Yale New Haven Hospital in Connecticut. For the past couple of years, he's been working on a proposal with UNOS to divide the country into fewer regions.
And the idea is that it's not really fair for people to have to suffer and actually die compared to someone who may live a few states away and can get an organ much more easily.
Generally, centers in the Southeast and the Midwest transplant patients with lower scores than ones in the Northeast or along the West Coast. Researchers disagree about why this is the case and what to do about it. Reasons seem to shift depending on who you talk to. It's a tricky combination of factors that include average lifespan, organ donor rates, and healthcare access in each region. And because relocating is costly, Mulligan says, the current system leaves people who can't afford to move at a disadvantage.
We're all not available to have private jet waiting on standby to take us to whichever transplant center calls us the first to say, "We've got a liver, come on out and have your transplant."
The point of the redistricting plan is to get patients transplanted around the same score everywhere. regions would morph in shape and size to include more states. It would mean more sharing between states and more livers being flown around.
We're in a desperate situation in California. We're desperate.
Catherine Frenette is the medical director of liver transplantation at Scripps Green Hospital in San Diego, California.
I know the middle of the country is fighting hard against redistricting because they don't want to give up their livers. They're in their thoughts, well, everything's fine. We're transplanting people. We're getting livers when we need them. Why are we going to change it? Why should we ship our livers to California?
Some surgeons say redistricting will only change which patients die because there are only so many livers to go around. Some will have to wait longer. John Hundley is a transplant surgeon at Piedmont Hospital in Atlanta, Georgia.
I can say this without any shadow of a doubt. This redistricting, it would cause more Georgians to die and fewer New Yorkers to die. That's what would happen. I mean, there'd still be just as many deaths.
Hundley also admits, as many have, that everyone wants what's best for their patients. Whether redistricting is the answer or not, the current system entices patients to relocate. Patients like Seth Doraswamy.
Taking a lot of blood today.
After being in Florida for 2 weeks, the clinic agreed to put him on the wait list. He just needed to get approval from his insurance.
We heard back that they would cover my transplant here, which is a huge relief, so now it's just the waiting game. They just said, keep your phone charged, on loud as it can be, have a little backpack ready.
Then, a few weeks later, he got deathly ill. His MELD score shot up to 40, the highest it can be, and he went into the ICU.
Maybe close to around midnight, I heard a doctor come into the room, start talking to one of my nurses. He came over and just out of the blue announced to me, we may have a liver this evening. Being in the hospital already, I was just lying in bed and just started thinking inside my head, you know, maybe this is it.
On September 24th, around 3 o'clock in the morning, anesthesiologists came in to ready him for the surgery. When Seth came to, he was covered in tubes and wires and in a lot of pain. But even with the pain, he noticed positive changes almost immediately.
When I went to the bathroom after surgery, I almost wanted to cry because since I was a little boy, I only saw dark urine. And so when I saw clear urine, I jumped out of the bathroom like a 2-year-old boy and announced to my wife that I just peed normally for the first time in decades.
A couple months later, when I visit him in Boston, Seth looks like a different person. Gone are the puffy cheeks and the yellow eyes. He's laughing easily and tossing a ball around with Benji.
Papa, you're
the amount of people traveling for liver transplants like Seth is unclear, but research shows travelers are 74% more likely to get a transplant than similar patients who stay put.
If I hadn't done that, then who knows what my fate would have been up here.
Where do you want me to go?
There's no way of knowing, of course, but one thing is clear. He's never been more excited about the future. For The Pulse, I'm Karen Chakurji.
We produced this piece late last year, and we just found out it has won an Association of Healthcare Journalists Award, so congratulations to Karen and to Joel Patterson, who edited this feature. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Libby Tracy is our intern, Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Paige Flager, the associate producer, Joel Patterson, our managing editor, and Megan Pinto, our executive producer. Next week on The Pulse, what if a higher power told you to make a sacrifice that could impact your health in a serious way?
I'm telling you, I knew as sure as I'm sitting here that, you know, I mean, God never spoke to me before, but I know that's what that was, and I knew it was going to be fine.
Don't miss that edition of The Pulse. Subscribe to our podcast. It's on iTunes. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.